Six Music.
Some guests foist themselves upon the unsuspecting radio programme like charity chuggers. Others take a little bit of patience and organisation to track down. Then there are others, so elusive and recalcitrant even, that getting them on air is akin to catching a badger at it on Springwatch. He is hands down one of my favourite comedians, and I can't remember what the number was, like the 44th favourite as voted for by Channel 4 viewers a few years ago. Here to grace our Comedy Legends Week, it is STEWART Stuart Lee.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming in.
I wasn't that elusive, was I? I just got some emails and then I lost track of it for a bit, actually. Yeah. You know, it's because they all, you know, your emails pile up, don't they? And then you don't look at them for ages, and then you realise you've missed all the deadlines. So anyway, I'm here now.
That's all that matters.
Yeah,
I got a severe case, a crippling case of guest envy, and I don't get it all very often, but because we were trying to get you a while ago. But you're friends with a friend of ours, friend of the show, friend of the station. I'm talking about Stuart McConey now.
Well, I'm going on that. Yeah, I've been on it at some point. Yeah. Why not? Well, I knew him 20 years ago, you know, when he was writing radio comedy.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Oh, all those
him
years
and Andrew
ago.
Collins used to write sort of sketches and things. And
Collins and McConey.
Yeah. You know what? It's probably even longer than 20 years ago. We used to come into this, a building that's literally not here anymore. That window there, just across there, was this fantastic old, you know, where all the radio comedy was done. And in the late 80s, you could just turn up, right? There was this weekly programme called Weekending that was like lame sketches about the news. And you could turn up at the security guard at the gate and you go, I'd like to try and write for Weekending. And he'd go, oh, fill in this form. And then you'd go upstairs and someone would talk to you and tell you what the programme was looking for that week and send you away. And that is how loads of people got to be writing for comedy for radio.
Wow.
Can you imagine that now?
No.
There was no, like, real checks or anything. And there were, and also, a lot of people that wanted to write radio comedy were just mad anyway.
Yeah.
And would sort of end up just staying in the building and sleeping under desks and things. And some of those went on to be people like Douglas Adams and Richard Curtis. But, you know, it was, when they sort of go now, there's a lot of money invested in that. Like, why do we find the new talent?
Yeah.
And they put like a footballer in a shopping centre with a booth sort of going, hey, can you write a sketch, you know, or something. But actually what used to happen was people literally used to wander in off the street and that's how the BBC found new talent. But that building's been knocked down.
Yeah, it's gone now.
That glass building's in its place.
Yeah, along with the dream.
Yeah.
It's been knocked down. It's been raised to the ground, hasn't it? That open door policy has been, that open door has been kicked into the face.
Yeah, and replaced by a towering, imposing structure saying, don't try and
come here,
you idiot. This isn't for you.
Go to ITV4.
That's right.
With your lame ideas. Yeah. Well, there you go, you see. I mean, I almost go as far as to say you to me like a sort of comedy version of David Bowie, you know, sort of difficult to, you know, what will he do next? Who will he speak to? But that's not quite accurate because you are out there. You have got a presence. You write for different publications and things.
I mean,
Bowie's
orchestrated that to an extent. Mine's just a degree of incompetence. But also, I don't. People think, oh, why haven't you done that? When did that? I don't get. I'm off the radar of most people, which has sort of worked out really well. It means you can sort of carry on doing what you want to do without it being compromised by the idea of celebrity.
Yeah.
But I think it's quite, if you're a stand-up and you're famous as a celebrity, I think it's quite hard to sort of talk about certain things because it's sort of filtered through the prism of you.
Yes.
I always notice this whenever Paul McCartney's interviewed, for example, he always goes, you know what it's like? You're on the bus and you're having a... You're not on the bus! Because if you were, people would be going, there's Paul McCartney. And also when Jimmy Carr says, you know, you go in a shop and whatever, he can't know what it's like to go into a shop. Because if he goes into a shop...
People are reacting to him.
And I'm a little more aware of that now. But on the whole, I managed to sort of have fairly average kinds of experiences and then report back on them without it being changed.
How much I would love to see Stuart on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, for instance, you know, just because of the juxtaposition. It would be magical in a sense for me to see.
I'm as unknown as a lot of the people that are on that.
Exactly.
You know what, I just couldn't do that because first of all, I'd be so embarrassed to be filmed all the time. Secondly, I couldn't eat all those insects and stuff. I watch it and think it's unfair on the internet. Again, I'm not trying to be funny. I think they are alive, you know. Like, do they need to be eaten by...
For entertainment.
For entertainment.
If you're eating it for sustenance, because you're in the jungle, that's different. If you're eating it...
No, I do. I'm not
You're
even
a bit worried about the cockroaches and things.
Yeah, I think it's... I just can't understand how we've got to a state where the needless mutilation of insects is like mainstream entertainment. But the other thing is, I couldn't do it because if you were observed all the time and people sort of would know what your real concerns were or what you were really like, and I kind of think with the stand-up, I like to be able to say things or make up stories and for people to think that they might be true. And sometimes things that I'd say that have happened to me, I go online and people are going, no, why did he make that up? Why has he lied about that? And other times, things that I've made up, people think that. But they're real. But if you were observed all the time, you'd blow it, I think.
You've no filter.
Yeah.
I prefer to call it, I've got a tax bill, get me in there.
Yeah.
I having watched you for quite some time and read some of your books and things, it does feel that, you know, at certain points in your career, you've been so bloody-minded as to you want to inflict sort of kind of pain and ennui on the audience. You would agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's partly, for better or worse, a lot of the things that I've come to like in music or film or television or whatever, or books, are often that kind of thing, where you sort of hate it. And then a kind of switch flips, and you go, it's really good. I mean, I really like The Fall, you know, and I remember when I first heard them, I thought it was the worst thing I'd ever. I couldn't understand why anyone would make it or listen to it. But then John Peel kept playing it all the time in the early 80s, and it wore you down at the end. You know, and you suddenly thought, oh, no, I can't live without it. It's the same with lots of, you know, films. It's like those spaghetti westerns, you know, I love the Morricone spaghetti, and they seem on the verge of intolerable often with those long shots, and then it can just flip, you know. But also I think it's a way of being distinctive now as well, because everything's chopped down into little bite-sized pieces now, and you expect to be able to flip between things and pick up what's going on. And I kind of like the idea that you have to invest in it.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of people being, when they come to see you live, they're sort of stuck in a room. I mean, they can walk out.
But that's quite a bold statement in and of itself. And most people don't do that, do they? Even if they want to, really.
Not if they want. No, and I think, you know, I'm aware that people tell me that they brought their partner along or whatever, and they hated it. But by the end, sort of developed a grudging respect for the bloody whiteness of it, which in the end may develop into them actually liking it. So it wasn't a plan. But when I look at the things that I like, I can see where it's come from.
Well, it is like, it's a bit like staring at a patch of the night sky, I think. Yeah. The longer you stare at it, the more it reveals itself, doesn't it? And things like that. I mean, you know, it's like, is it true that you catalogue, to go back to some of the music that you like, you've got like 20 feet's worth of European avant-garde jazz
or
something?
I've got a lot, I mean, again, that sort of stuff.
It does take a lot of investment of time, doesn't it?
Investment of time. And that seems to me to be sort of, because everything's available all the time now, sometimes the more interesting things are stuff where you kind of have to struggle with it. I mean, that new Polyakov drama has got a lot of Dancing at the Edge of Time. Is that what it's called? Dancing on the Edges. It's had a lot of abuse, you know, bad reviews, people hating it. And I only watched the first one, right? But I think the problem with it was, for reviews, that it wasn't immediately apparent what it was about.
We're trying to get out.
Whereas when you watch a Charlie Brooker drama, you know, they're very good, by the way, I'm not criticising, but you know they're a satire, and you know that particular things stand for other things, and you can sort of decode it. Whereas something that's a bit obtuse or elliptical, it takes a bit more, you know, there may not be an obvious meaning. People seem to get infuriated by it. And people's annoyance is funny. I mean, I must admit, I hate the idea that someone might have paid for a babysitter and come out in good faith to see me on a Friday night and have hated it. And I do my best to avoid that happening. Yeah. You can check me out on, see what I'm like online, and I always put a bad review on a poster that gives you an indication that it may not be for you. But there is something funny about going online and looking at people that have, they're spitting rage about it. And also, I'll know it was a gig that went well.
Yeah, so it's not because it was a stinker. It was because they've missed a point somewhere.
And the fact that there's people around them really laughing makes them more and more angry. And they have to go online to sort of justify them, to sort of have the last word, as if they're going, if you look online, you'll see that I said this, therefore I believe it was I that wrote, this is rubbish. I refer you to the internet, you know. So it is something funny about people. Because often it's not even contentious material or language. It's just, they just hate the whole
Well, this is what I think is brilliant. And you see it done to good effect. You do it on the one of the series of Comedy Vehicle, and it's a brilliant way of orchestrating the audience. You're sort of saying, okay, well, I did that joke. It's very... I don't know whether it's meta or it's post something, but it's great. You know, this bit of the audience found that funny.
Yeah.
These guys at the back, a bit of a lag. Some of them didn't find it funny at all. We're going to try. We're going to sell the next gag to those guys. That whole thing is just brilliantly.
Well, you know what? I've wanted to stop. I've been doing that for 2 or 3 years now. And I wanted to stop doing it, right, breaking the audience down into groups. But the better known you get, and when you're known as an award winner or whatever, and you're doing bigger rooms, more people come along who don't necessarily know you and are expecting particular kinds of things. And also, which they don't necessarily get. And also, people that like you are more excited about seeing you. So there's a kind of amazing goodwill in the room sometimes that actually I don't think makes for good comedy. I don't think you want everyone behind you, because there's nothing at stake. And in a good drama or a good piece of music, you feel like there's some danger. Not danger like you're going to offend the Pope, but danger like something could go wrong.
Yeah.
Like with jugglers, a good juggler will pretend to drop the plate. And when one's smashed, instead of going, oh, another juggler's spinning plates around, you think, oh, it might break one. Yeah. Well, you know, the exciting thing about motor racing is the risk of people blowing themselves to pieces in it. So I think what I'm going to do there is I'll try to make things go a bit wrong.
Yeah.
So that there's something.
Yeah,
at stake.
I get it.
And the risk there is that sometimes
you could take it, could can, just loot the wheels could fall it. Off
the
at some point.
Fall off.
But that's good for you as well, adrenaline wise,
well,
isn't
it? It can be. And you know, 99 times out of 100, you can get it back. And when you don't, you get the taste of the failure again. That is what it was like 20, 25 years ago. It's the first time that reminds you what your obligations are.
Yeah.
You know, and so. I remember reading a piece about Michael McIntyre, and I wouldn't envy him this situation at all, where he comes out on stage at Wembley or somewhere, loads of the people in that room have probably never been to comedy before, they get up and they run to the front and go, yay!
It's like Beatlemania.
And then they realise that sort of is going to be a mountain, they're going to go and sit down again. So there's a kind of, if you're famous, there's a kind of spurt of excitement and goodwill that I feel you have to sabotage. In order to get a level playing field, you know, you have to go, hey, it's not me that good. Come on. It's just a bloke talking.
We should talk about the stuff that you're doing now. You've got a couple of things on the go. First of all, Much a Stew About Nothing.
Yeah.
I like the title.
That's a show that I'm touring at a bit less than I'd normally charge of all the material that will become the third series of Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle, which is filmed at the end of this year.
Mm.
And
is it in the same configuration, like that sort of smoky sort of?
Well, hopefully it'll be back at the Mildmay Club, which is an old working men's club in Hackney, just up Newington.
Brilliant.
I went all round the country looking for the perfect venue, and then found one about 5 minutes walk from where I live. And what's great about the Mildmay Club is it's a beautiful old building that's been kept in. It's still got the feel of a working men's club, and it doesn't feel like you're trying to be kitsch, and it also doesn't feel like you're trying to be. Weird by going there. It doesn't look like a TV studio. Yeah. And because it's such a beautiful building and you feel like it's a privilege to be in there, the audience are in a really good mood, you know, whereas often going to TV records, they're sort of funneled through these sheet dips and given some tango.
Laugh now!
Stop. I mean, it's better now than it was. When I used to do stuff in the 90s with Richard Herring, Fist of Fun,
of course,
for BBC Two, the audience supply company, literally a lot of those audiences in the... For us, they'd come to see Bruce Forsyth.
I was going to say, they'd come for Family Fortunes or something.
And the overspill would be given to... And, you know, and you'd come
That's
off
horrible.
And think, that didn't go very well. And then you'd realise it because everyone was going, oh, I wish I was seeing Bruce. What's this? You know,
where's Leslie Crowther?
Yeah, I know. So it is, they're doing that again. And what I tend to do is I'll flag up at the start of the night that I'm trying to work out 6 half-hour blocks of material and that they'll see 4 of them, you know. And for the second series, I really... worked on making it all work in half hours.
Yeah.
I didn't try and write lots of random stuff, and the second series is much better for that, so you sort of break it down into blocks like that. And then I'll do about 200 gigs between now and Christmas.
Good God.
And so by the time I do the series, I know the stuff well enough to actually throw it away. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah,
is,
okay.
Because a lot of comics now, the material gets written on the day by the program associates, and they're working off auto cues.
Yeah.
But actually, I think you need to know it well enough to be able to, improvise with it. And in the second series of Comedy Vehicle, there were some great bits where things happened in the room, like people stood up or walked out, and I just ended up not doing stuff that I'd written because
something funnier happened,
and it's actually, I thought, well, you know, I'll let it go, and that's the stage you want to be at, so that there can be just some of it happening in real time. Of course, you then look online and people go, it's amazing how they orchestrated those walkouts just at the right time for him to deliver that clearly prepared line.
We're all massively cynical now, aren't we? It's all every single moment scripted when he dropped that glass.
Even there was a drop glass bit, and people went, I wonder if the glass was dropped by a stage person or did they dub the sound on? Like, you know, but also even with the live shows, the show before last, if you prefer a milder comedian, there was a long bit at the end when I was in the audience for about half an hour complaining about advertising and how it, you know. But anyway, there'd always be somebody that would walk out during that bit, and I could normally have a go at them. But it wasn't staged. Yeah. And, you know, I look online and people go, oh, that happened when he did it. He must have a person that he takes around. I remember going to see Al Murray, the pub landlord, with my dad about 15 years ago. And, I mean, Al's amazing at working with an audience, you know, and there'll be 20 people and he'll ask them all their jobs and he'll remember them and he'll refer back to them all night and build them into the narrative of the show. And my dad came out saying, it's amazing how he knew where all those people were sitting and he'd arranged everything with them before. You know, that would be harder than just improvising. It'd be harder to, like...
Why would you be arsed?
And also he'd have to have a big bus going around the country with all these, like... all these
acolytes,
extras,
yeah. You
know? But that's what I'm doing over from now to Christmas. Much to do about nothing will be a little bit different every night. And I'm taking it to... I'm touring it September, October, but I'm taking it to as many places as I can. But I've got to wrap it up by Christmas. And I'll do a few in January, but it's got to all be done before the show goes out.
Speaking of TV, the Alternative Comedy Experience TV show.
Yeah.
So this is like your Michael McIntyre's roadshow, isn't it, really? Well, essentially, it's the same thing. It's live at the Apollo with Stuart Lee.
It's live in it. Well, I tried really hard to not have my name in the title.
Yeah.
Because I think Michael McIntyre is very good at what he does, but I think that I didn't want to be this person going, and now, by the grace of my hand, I give you... the comedians that are not as good as me. It does feel a bit like that, doesn't it, when you're like the host of a thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, loads of the people on it are people that it inspired me. So I don't actually host it. I just interview people backstage, and there isn't really a host. And it's basically all the comics that the comedians like in a small room in the stand in Edinburgh where, like I say, stuff can happen and there aren't cutaways to Gokwan laughing. and there's just some angry Scottish people not always enjoying it. It's come out really well.
Yeah.
I mean, it was sort of a Trojan horse in a way of getting... How do you get weird acts onto telly? Well, give up on BBC One and on BBC Two and Channel Four. It's all sewn up. Forget it. But if you could do it on Comedy Central, if you could sort of disguise it a bit... You know, there's a lot of fast editing in the first half of the show. Then the second half, people get to do longer sets. And, you know, I think it's... It's done about three times as well as they were expecting.
Wow. Yeah, and it continues. So is it just ongoing?
Well, there's 13 weeks of the first one.
Brilliant.
And there's four or five acts every week, and people sort of drift in for a few weeks and then go off again. But there's some brilliant people in it. And hopefully, if we get to do a second one, what I'd like to do now we've got the channel on our side more is get more older people and more younger people.
It's just a state of mind rather than a particular sort of genre, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, you could put... Arnold Brown, who's 70-odd, on the same show as David Kaye, who's 30, and they do feel of a piece. And I think that's a hard thing to explain to marketing people, because marketing people, you must have a lot of meetings here about demographics and whatever, and I expect the assumption about BBC, about Six Music is it's for a particular age, whatever. But actually, because of YouTube and Spotify and whatever, the way that young people consume things, there's no demographic logic to it.
Yeah.
And you see this with bands now. Like you think, why does that... This has a Van de Graaff generator. Why, you know, why do they sound like that? Because no one our age, that was in the bin.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
Now they jump about and they'll put that next to hip-hop and mix it up. Basically, they're idiots. They don't understand that you can't do that.
We've got boxes for a reason, guys. Come on.
But I don't think a young person thinks... That musician's old, therefore
exactly.
I won't like them. Or that person's young, so I will like them. They dislike and like people, irrespective of their
And that's age. Something to be sort of encouraged very much. Really. I mean, because you mentioned Dave Allen a lot about, you know, as being somebody where he's still alive, he would be perfect because he's just one of those. Well, he's just got an incredible storytelling vibe to him. And
well, you know, I mean, if anyone's never, if there are any young people mistakenly listening to Six Music and you've never seen Dave Allen, you need to go on YouTube and look at it because you can't understand how that was happening then, because there doesn't seem to be any context for it.
It's
brilliant stuff. Yeah. And also the other amazing thing about it is, like we were talking about people concentrating on things, a mainstream broadcaster, BBC One and ITV in the 70s, had the confidence to have a man just sit on a stool and talk in one camera shot normally for about half an hour with some not very good sketches dropped in at one point. But on the whole, they thought, well, this is interesting. They'll listen to this. On the other hand, though, viewers then didn't have the option of flicking around to the adult
kind of
channel.
Captive audience.
You know, they went, oh, what's that? You know, but people did love it. And, you know, the sad thing for people like Dave Allen and even later people like Alexis Salem, whatever, they'd started to disappear from the scene before the era we're in now, where far lesser talents are able to play to literally millions of people and enjoy a financial compensation for it beyond the wildest dreams of anyone.
It's
who
very
did.
Rock star yeah. these days.
I mean, I'm not on the radar of say lots of people, but I can tour at a level that really well known comics couldn't 20 years ago because there just wasn't this tradition of going out to stuff, and you know, it's an amazing time.
And you did come in, you did get as far as Holborn with your helicopter as well, which not many people know. But you're right about Dave Allen, though. You probably know they'd be scrolling live texts from viewers now, you know, just to sex it up a bit, wouldn't they?
Yeah, so who is this fag? Question mark.
Well, you know, if you're looking for comedians for that program, the Alternative Comedy Experience TV show, look no further than me. I can always make myself available.
Okay. And
I'm pretty ropey, but I've got a couple of bits.
Yeah.
But what can we say except finally we got him, we bagged him. And I'm pleased to say that it's been a lovely experience. A great thing to have on our Comedy Legends week, as far as I'm concerned. And we've had a proper good old chat about comedy. Catch him when you can. He's going to be doing 200 gigs between now and Christmas, for God's sake. He should be able to. But thank you so much for coming in, Mr. Stuart Lee.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this free download from the BBC. For more Six Music downloads like Sean Keaveney, go to the Six Music website now.